From KRCB in Santa Rosa, it's Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour with Michelle Anna Jordan.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.
You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out of.
Kid, listen. You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil, and you fry some garlic, and you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. And you gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs, and a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
Mashed potatoes, yeah.
I eat with gusto, damn, you bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
From KRCB in Santa Rosa, it's Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour with Michelle Anna Jordan. Thanks for tuning in. We have a really special show tonight. A guest I have wanted to have probably since I first conceived of Mouthful nearly 10 years ago. We have Kermit Lynch, wine merchant, author, and yes, indeed, blues musician up from Berkeley. Welcome to Mouthful.
Thank you.
We also have a friend of yours, very special guest here in the studio with us. That is Boss Skaggs. Welcome to Mouthful. It's really a pleasure.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Let's start with the CD and work backwards from there. Because I know this is probably the best kept secret about you. I think any wine lover knows Kermit Lynch, wine merchant there in Berkeley. And I think really passionate wine lovers know your first book. And there's a new book out as well. But I think it's kind of a secret that you're also a musician and that in about a month you're going to have an album out.
I don't think it. You could call it a secret. I'm not really a musician.
So tell us, how did this ended up with great musicians.
I'm not a musician, but I have a CD. Yeah.
Okay, so tell us about it.
Well, it's a collection of songs that I wrote long ago before I got into the wine business. And I had a non-career as a rock and roll musician when I was younger. And I gave it up except for there were a few songs that I liked, and I always wished I could hear them done by a bunch of good people. And I met Boz through the wine business. Boz has a vineyard in Napa, and he's a wine lover too. And he got a chance to hear some of the songs, and the next day he'd forgotten about it, but I reminded him that he promised to get together some musicians and record these songs.
But you're also, and you're part of the recordings.
I do take part in it, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Certainly in the studio, I tried to get my two cents in as often as I could, and I sing a couple of the songs.
Uh-huh. And what's it called?
It's coming out in about a month, and it's called Quicksand Blues.
Mm-hmm. And throughout the evening, we'll be hearing some cuts off of that. So, Boz, tell me about your vineyard.
I've got 2 acres up in the Mount Veeder region.
Oh, okay.
They're probably, they must be 8 years old, 9 years old, some of them by now. And I have Rhone varietals. I have some Grenache, some Syrah, some Mourvèdre, some Roussanne. And, well, it's hand-farmed. It's up in the hills. It's sustainable agriculture, and we make a a wine that's unfiltered, unfined, and the real purity thing.
Mm-hmm. And when, what's the label?
It's called Skaggs, of all
Skaggs.
Things. Mm-hmm. I tried Soaring Falcon and his master's voice and all sorts of exotic things to sort of spice it up, but it all sort of comes down to nothing worked, so I went by the old tried and true standard, call it by the vineyard owner's name.
There you go. Mm-hmm. And that's a real good introduction to Kermit Lynch Wine Merchant, because I know that that's the first place that I really began to get acquainted with Rhone varietals. You have a great selection, though it was Beaujolais that first took me into your store. After coming back from France in, 1990, I hightailed it down to Berkeley and came home with my first case of wine, Beaujolais, under your label. And that kept me from being too depressed about not being in France for a while. But why don't you let's talk a little bit about the history of the store, because it's a unique store and as wonderful today as the first time I walked in there.
I guess it is unique. It's to be so close to the wine country here in California and yet sell only the wines that I import. Mm-hmm. In other words, French and Italian wines. Mm-hmm. It is unusual. There are importers who specialize in Italian and French wines, but they don't have their own retail shop. And that's how I began, was with the retail shop, and then became an importer.
You started out by selling wines all of other labels.
That's right. Uh-huh. I sold wines from all over. I didn't have many wines. I opened that store with 35 cases of wine for sale. But it was a mixture. And then as I went on, I sort of followed my nose, followed my own interest, and that meant French and Italian.
Mm-hmm. And what year did the store open?
1972.
Mm-hmm. And not at its current location.
It was about a mile away.
About a mile.
Same street.
Uh-huh. So it really opened the same, was that the same year as Chez Panisse, 72?
It was. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you were part of that whole explosion.
Without realizing it, right. I didn't know Alice then, but of course that happened soon enough.
Mm-hmm. I said, okay. And how did you two meet?
Well, I met her when I went to dine and, course, trying to sell wine to Chez Panisse. But also, next door to my store in those days, there was a strange little restaurant. It was it was an Indian chef, and by that I mean from India, who had married a Mexican woman. So he made Mexican and Indian cuisine, and it was great. But it was always empty. It was food nobody understood in those days, And Alice loved it, and she would often show up for lunch and stick her head in the door of my place and see if I was free. And that's how we got to be friends.
Uh-huh. And so the store went along from 72 until what year?
In 1981, I got the new place. Uh-huh. And Alice sort of joined me. She opened Cafe Fanny right next door.
And Acme
Bread right next
there.
To her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sort of allowed me to do it because they agreed to. I bought the building, and I couldn't have done it unless they had agreed to rent the two spaces.
It's one of the great one-stop shopping areas in the entire Bay Area. You go and have a little something to eat at Cafe Fanny, you pick up your bread, and then you go next door and spend time. And you also have a small selection of other products in addition to wine. I used to drive down and buy olive oil all the time from you until Sonoma County got what I think is probably California's best olive oil. Mm-hmm. With Davero. I used to come down. I think you had, for a while, you had Pocho Lamentano.
Yes, I did.
Which was just a wonderful oil.
And there were things I didn't really set out to buy those. I would run across things every once in a while I was looking for wines over there and just think, well, I'd like to have this at home, so I'd bring some to sell, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really good. If I remember correctly, you also had a really wonderful mustard.
Yeah, I still do, that Peak.
Is that Peak?
Mustard,
Peak,
right?
That's my favorite mustard in the world. In fact, I used to come down and buy it by the case.
And we had some incredible anchovies from Peak.
Yeah.
And finally, the FDA, was it the FDA? Who was it? Wouldn't allow us to import them anymore because they weren't sterile enough.
Really?
And they were so popular. And
yeah,
people,
they were really good.
People threatened to take it out on me, but it wasn't my fault that I couldn't import them anymore.
Yeah, they were really excellent.
It's our government protecting us again from ourselves.
Yes, from anything that tastes too good, you know. You don't want to get all passionate about what you're eating.
Right.
Not in America. So you were importing wine that was basically wine bottled by vintner in France initially.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
How do you make the leap then to what you did where it's in your own label? I think a lot of people don't really understand what that process is.
With me, it's, again, it's sort of accidental. It wasn't planned. Actually, it started when I found a wine. I believe it was a Côte du Rhône, a red Côte du Rhône. And the winemaker already had an exclusive arrangement with an American importer. So I liked it so much, and the price was good. So I thought, well, I'll just make up a label to import this wine because I didn't want to miss it. And then I found a good Mâcon village from a cave cooperative, and I hated their label. So I decided, well, I'll use the same label, only, you know, put Mâcon on it. That's how it started. And I don't import these wines every year. It's when I find something and that seems to be the right way to do it. That's when I do it. Right now I only have two wines with my own label.
Oh, really?
One's a Côte du Rhône red, and the other is, it's from the Rhône, but it only has the right to call itself Vin de Table.
Mm. Now, how does that work when you're importing to label? Does it come over, the wine come over already in bottles without a label?
Oh,
does
yes.
it come over
no,
in barrels?
It comes,
can't come over in barrels,
it comes
right?
over bottled. It can come in
okay,
barrel, but
okay.
it, the way I do it and most importers, it comes in bottle. It's already labeled and everything, and even the import strips legislated by our government, that's put on in France,
so you just
too.
Contract, they have your labels.
Right.
They send it over that way.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's a real hassle. It's unbelievable if people knew what goes into getting some wine into this country, because there's alcohol in wine. You can't forget that, the demon alcohol.
Oh, so what do you have to go through to get it in?
So the BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Yes, my fine wines.
Right there
under,
next to the guns.
Yes, next to the guns. And there's restrictions on the size of the print where you say alcohol. It's so strange. It's just the opposite, too, of the way they do it in France. Here, they put it has to be a certain height of the letters. And they act like if you go larger than that, you're advertising
you're
the alcohol, right?
Drink
this one; it has more alcohol than his wine, you know. And the French look at it just the other, in the other direction. It's funny, these national, governmental regulations.
So each time you bring in a new wine, is it the hassle all over again, or do you sort of establish yourself? Okay, you're importing, and you don't have to go through all the junk again.
It's a constant hassle because. As French wines are labeled or Italian wines, they don't fit our norms. So we have to have special labels made. Mm. And for example, in France, they'll say produit de France, you know, and we have to say product of France. And I can be fined if I don't do that. If it comes in saying produit de France and the BATF's in a bad mood.
They'll fine you for not doing the translation?
Right.
Well, not only are we protected from alcohol, we're protected from the French language. Don't want to make Americans feel insecure, you know.
Not just French. It's true in Germany,
and
Italy. But and the French, too, are they're more legislated than we are
really?
These days. And they suffer from it a lot, too. And we've reached the point now where a label that's legal to the French is not legal over here, and the label that I have to have for over here is not legal in France. It's just absurd, all these. And, you know, they do it in the name, again, of protecting us.
Interesting. Well, I think we should take a musical break. So why don't you tell us what cut we should hear?
Well, let's start with the blues. It's cut number 9, and it's called It's Cold.
And that's the truth, isn't it? Okay, here you go.
Thank you.
cigarette and a bottle of wine. I'm trying to drag myself, I'm crying.
It's cold. Yeah, baby, it's cold.
I say the weatherman froze, but the hot water is in my bag. You know what I'm talking about. Torn blankets and a smoking fire. My woman loved me like a blowed out tire.
It's cold.
Yeah, baby, it's cold.
It's Michelle Jordan. It is Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. My guest this evening, Kermit Lynch, author of Adventures on the Wine Road and the new Inspiring Thirst from a 10-speed, out just about a month. Also in the studio with us is Boss Gags, who you can hear on the new CD, Quicksand Blues. Yes,
right.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to both of you for joining us. Before we talk about the new book, I want to talk a little bit about the old or previous book, Adventures on the Wine Road, A Wine Buyer's Tour of France, because I find it just one of the most engaging, probably the most engaging book I've ever read on wine.
Thank you.
I just put you right there, and I was rereading tonight the chapter on Beaujolais, and I want you to talk a little bit about it, both from the point of view of when you were writing the book and how much it may or may not have changed today, because I know that after you pull everyone in on just how good Beaujolais is and how perfect it is for the cuisine of the region, Lyon, then you tell us it's not available. It's gone. It's a memory.
And for a few years, that, to my mind, was true. I mentioned in the chapter a sort of hero of mine, Jules Chauvet, who made a natural Beaujolais. That's what's rare, is to get a natural Beaujolais.
Now, what does that mean, natural?
Well, one that isn't chaptalized to raise the alcohol, mm-hmm. One that doesn't have color added to make it dark, one that doesn't have new oak, to follow the new oak fad, and even mm-hmm. I think some of them they're adding perfumes.
Really?
To my mind, yeah. They're also using yeasts that will add certain aromas that are mm-hmm. not natural to the Beaujolais region.
Now, in what way do you actually add color if you're not doing it with another grape?
Well, you add it with what is that, a tinting material.
Really?
So, it's easy, sure.
I did not know
just
that.
Just like you can add the taste of oak by putting in oak chips.
Oak chips, yeah, that I knew. Yeah.
So they add tannin, acid. There's a lot of things you can add these days.
And why?
The technology has advanced quite a bit.
Why was that done with Beaujolais? Why were the French inclined to change the natural character of Beaujolais?
Well, I think they wanted to join this bandwagon of ultra-fruity wines with a big wallop, because alcohol is mainly alcohol and tannin is what gives you a wallop in a wine.
Mm-hmm. Could you explain?
And Beaujolais I mean, a natural Beaujolais is actually light in alcohol.
Yeah, around 9 to 11%, depending on the weather that particular year.
That's right, and that can be really charming. You can take pretty good sized swallows that way mm-hmm. without suffering a headache the next day. But instead, they try to make it taste like a big Burgundy or a big Cabernet or something mm-hmm. like that.
Has that trend reversed at all since you wrote the book?
That's what I was going to say. The pendulum is swinging in the other direction. I discovered a group of four winemakers in the Beaujolais village of Morgon. And they do it the old way, and it's a light wine, except certain years, like mm-hmm. 2003 was a real hot, dry year, and so they have a natural alcohol over 13 degrees. But it's natural. It's a big wine, but it's a natural wine.
Mm-hmm.
But Beaujolais, the normal Beaujolais from a normal year, it's more like 11 degrees alcohol and kind of a real burst of fruit, a real lively wine on the palate. That's its pleasure, not the size of it.
Right, and it was designed, the Lyonnaise cuisine, lots of sausage, big flavors.
A lot of innards.
A lot of innards, yeah. That's probably why
and,
I like it so much.
And they wanted a wine that they could drink with it, that, you know, to their thirst, because it's a cuisine that inspires thirst so to speak, and also with a natural acidity to sort of cut through these really rich dishes.
Or the pork fat.
Right.
Cut through the pork fat. I love the way you end the chapter, and I'm just going to hand it to you. I hate to put you on the spot, but I'm going to, rather than reading it myself, will you just read the last line?
Beaujolais should not be a civilized society, lady. Oh, yes, I see. Should not be a civilized society, lady. It is the one-night stand of wines.
I just, every time I read that, it just makes me laugh with such pleasure. You see a lot of people looking down on Beaujolais. Mm-hmm. And I think because it's not ponderous.
But they look down on it with reason because uh-huh. so much of it is bad. And uh-huh. when you're burned once or twice, people, it's normal. You don't want to go back and get burned
again.
Okay,
sure.
And I think 99% of the wines labeled Beaujolais, I wouldn't want to drink them.
Mm-hmm.
But when you find the rare one, the natural one, it's such a treat.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the most delicious wines. You don't talk about how serious it is or uh-huh. the complexity. It's just delicious.
Uh-huh. And are you selling any right now?
Oh, sure.
Are some available?
Yeah. I have about 12 domains now. And when that chapter was written, I had none.
Oh, okay. I
had given up on it, yeah.
Uh-huh. And I assume that Beaujolais is also one of the lower priced of the reds. It doesn't bear a huge price tag.
That's right.
Today, so how much should somebody be spending on a bottle?
Well, today they range from the simple Beaujolais appellation, which is around $12.50 a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And they go up to the king of the Beaujolais is Moulin Avant. That's more like $20.
Mm-hmm. That's between 12 and 20.
Mm-hmm.
That's really
pretty reasonable.
Not bad, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so what you've done in this book is you've gone through all the major regions of France. And let's see, from the Loire Valley down to the south, the Rhone, Côte d'Or, Chablis. Let's talk a little bit about the Rhone, because that's another region I really associate with you. And it seems a safe bet to say since you first opened in 1972 until today, Rhones have, especially red Rhones, have gotten much more popular. The American public has really warmed to them a great deal.
It's true, yeah. The acceptance of them has really changed. When I opened the store, you didn't see domain bottled Rhone wines. They were mainly négociant bottlings. Big shippers who would blend wines, and mm-hmm. you were never even sure of getting the authentic wine that was on mm-hmm. the label. And now practically every Chateau Neuf du Pape made is imported into the United States, so it's really become maybe the most popular region in France for Americans in terms of wine.
Uh-huh. And how do you think the California Rhone varietals are comparing with those coming out of France today?
Well, for example, Boz's. I love it. I think it's so. I drink it all the time. He mm-hmm. he gave me a little bit, and well, we traded, didn't we? Didn't I have something you wanted?
Yeah, some musical.
Uh-huh. Now, Boz,
we have traded actually. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I assume you're doing a Rhone blend.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
And then the Roussanne. Are you bottling the Roussanne on its own?
Separate. Yeah.
Separately.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I learned recently that surprised me was blending a little bit of white into certain mm-hmm. Rhone varietals. I know here Russian Hill, for example, blends some Viognier into their Syrah.
And it's not just in the Rhone. That was done quite a bit in France.
Mm-hmm.
In Burgundy, it was done to the red Burgundies.
They
added Pinot Gris.
Oh, okay.
Actually, in the old days, it was mixed in the vineyard. They would just plant a few vines of Pinot Gris.
So the white would just be there.
It would be picked up at the same time. Uh-huh. And then when you get down to Côte Rôti, it's the Viognier that was planted with the Syrah.
Uh-huh.
And it was done really to add a little, in both cases, it was done to add a little lusciousness, because the Pinot Gris and the Viognier they make sort of round, rich wines.
Mm-hmm.
And also both of them are quite aromatic, even, you could say, exotically perfumed. So that added that to the reds.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah, I found that very interesting. And people at Russian Hill even said that it actually makes the red deeper when they blend in some of the Viognier.
Mm-hmm.
It brings out more color.
Deeper in Color. Well, yeah. I've never heard that.
Yeah, that's counterintuitive, but there you go. You hear a lot today about the French wine industry being in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Quite.
Where do you weigh in on that? What's your perception?
Well, I think they've got a government that is doing everything it can, not on purpose. I don't think it's on purpose, but it might as well be everything they can to break the back of the small French winemaker. And I see it as part of what we have in this country too. I'm going to just use a cliche, but let's talk about hamburgers. You know,
okay.
When I was a kid in my hometown, we had 9 or 10 San Luis Obispo, by the way. We had about 9 or 10 hamburger joints, and they were individually owned, and every one of them had a different hamburger.
You could probably even get a rare one.
What do you have today? You have 2 or 3 hamburger joints, and you know, coming into the studio tonight, I see the malls with all the same. You drive into L.A., you see exactly the same hamburger joints, and it's taking over. And what you get with a situation like that is somebody like McDonald's has so much money, they're so powerful, that if you want to open a hamburger joint on the corner of something and they don't want you to, they'll buy the property. They can buy legislation where the individual guy can't, and that's what's happened to the French winemakers. The French government much prefers these big négociant shippers, you know, with all their secretaries and accountants, and they're probably their political contributions.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't really thought about that side of things. A lot of people talk about the French just not being aggressive isn't really the right word, but the French sort of being above the self-promotion.
Above marketing.
Yeah, that you see from, you know, South America, Australia,
that's
everywhere.
Right.
So is that also contributing to the difficulties, do you think?
I think it is. Also, there's so much bureaucracy in France. I mean, the French winemakers often say to me these days, there's only 2 communist countries left, France and Cuba. And that's because they're so frustrated with all the rules.
Yeah. Do you see a lot of the smaller winemakers that you've always bought from? Do you see some of them getting out of the business?
I have seen one of my favorites. His name's Thierry Alleman in Cornas. He only has about 4 acres of vines. And he's so frustrated, he told me he was going to hire himself out now to one of those big shippers. And
he'll just sell his grapes?
He'll sell his grapes, probably sell his vineyards, and then get a day job with one of the big shippers. Yeah, it's really crushing. I've never seen their morale so low. And just this year, they've changed the laws about, you know, the alcohol test for drunk driving. And it's so low that if you have two wine glasses, I'm not talking 2 wine glasses like filled to the brim. I'm talking about 2 wine glasses like you're served in a restaurant where you have space to swirl and get the aroma. You're over the limit in France, and it's really killing the restaurant business and the wine business. There they can set up roadblocks, and they do just about anywhere, and everybody who drives through has to blow the balloon, whether they're suspicious or not.
Really?
Yeah. And it's a crusher, you know, people who don't want to go to restaurants and drink anymore.
Yeah. It's had some influence here in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard. I used to go to San Francisco for dinner on a moment's notice and drive back to Sebastopol, and I'm much less willing to do that now.
Yeah, it's crazy too when you think about this situation, because we don't want drunk driving, and yet look at the way the wine industry's going to higher and higher alcohol wines.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
It's just crazy, I think. I don't understand. We're seeing dry wines now at 17 degrees alcohol sometimes, and I can't swallow them because to me, they taste like cough syrup.
Yeah, I agree. And they're
the
terrible
thing
the next day.
They go to your head.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you know why we have that trend? What's going on with that?
Well, wines like that, a word I used before, they pack a wallop. Alcohol is strong, you know, and you think, oh, big wine. Well, what you're saying is a lot of alcohol.
And do you think the most influential critics have a bias towards wines that pack a wallop?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I don't blame them for that bias. They can have their bias. I blame the people, the sheep who follow them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody can like whatever kind mm-hmm. of wine they want, as far as I'm concerned, but to listen to that. But it's so much more appealing, isn't it, to say, wow, what a bomb. You know, this is a fruit bomb. This is this is explosive.
Yeah, you had a little piece in Severe Magazine recently about that, didn't you?
They reprinted it from in my new book, right?
Yeah, I couldn't have agreed with you more. I almost stood up and cheered. Why don't we take another little musical interlude, but you pick the track.
Okay, well, since we've got Boz here, let's do cut 3, because Boz plays a beautiful guitar solo on it.
Okay, there we go.
Lying in bed, dreaming of you. Why must I wake up feeling so blue? I'm awake for the count, awake for the count. I saw your face, as real as can be. You were looking at him the way you once looked at me. Smile was so loving, so carefree and gay. But when you saw me, it turned so cold and gray. All the love in your eyes seemed to disappear.
The song is Awake for the Count. It is from Quicksand Blues. That was Boz Scaggs on guitar. And the singer, Jackie Payne from Santa Rosa. It is songs by Kermit Lynch. So that was really awesome.
Thank you.
At some point, if I'm right, it was in the early 80s, you also started bringing in some Italian wines. Is that right?
I'd begun going to Italy much earlier, uh-huh. around 1976. And had at one time I had a lengthier list of Italian wines.
Mm-hmm.
But I still love to go there, even though the focus is French. I love to travel in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And eat in Italy. Still my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
More so than French food.
Any particular regions of Italy that draw you more than others?
Well, you know, I only know the wine regions, although Italy seems to grow grapes just about everywhere.
I was recently in Sicily, and there are vineyards everywhere in Sicily now.
But I have a weakness for Tuscany and the Piedmont.
Mm-hmm. Are you bringing in many Italian wines these days?
Not a lot. Only about 10% of the wines are from Italy.
Uh-huh. What are the varietals that most attract you when it comes to Italy?
I couldn't say, really. I love the inexpensive wines. You mm-hmm. know, I drink them more often than the big Barolos and things like mm-hmm. that. I love Dolcetto.
I was going to ask you about that. That's my favorite of the Italian varietals is Dolcetto.
Yeah, people don't understand that. I think, for one thing, wine writers often say it's the Beaujolais of Italy, which I don't see that at all. The only similarity it has with Beaujolais, I think, is that neither of them improve with age.
Mm.
They're both at their best when they're fairly young.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, they have nothing in common. The mm-hmm. flavors are completely different. The body's different. I'm a big fan of Pinot Grigio, and especially in the Friuli Tokaj, which isn't well-known uh-huh. here. But I love that. It's a Tokaj that's completely different from what they sell in Hungary or the Alsatian Tokaj. It's a local grape. It's spelled T-O-C-A-I. And it's dry and got a real kind of whispery texture to uh-huh. it on the palate, and this little tinge of bitterness at the end, and a little kind of fennelly touch, really subtle touch, but that keeps it real interesting, especially at table.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that's a really nice wine.
Yeah.
We've had, am I going to forget his name? We've had the wonderful author who is. Both produces opera and writes about Italian food. I will think of him in a minute. We've had him on talking about the Friuli, Friuli Giulia Venezia, that region.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he really made me curious about the wines of that region. Fred. I'll think of his last name before the show is over, I'm sure. So you have the new book out. Let's talk about that. So that's something that people are going to be able to go out and pick up right away. Although the original book, or the first book, Adventures on the Wine Road, that is still in print.
It is. Mm-hmm.
In its 12th print run, something like that.
I haven't kept up, but last I heard something like that.
Yeah, and it's Farrar, Strauss, Giraud, they're still the ones.
Their paperback division has it out now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the new one is from 10 Speed Press, the Berkeley publisher. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of excerpts from 30 years of your marvelous newsletter.
That's right. They came in and one of their editors came in and asked me if that interested me and to do an anthology, to go through and try to pick out the best reads, mm-hmm. you know, from 30 years of it. And it was really fun to do. Yeah, mm-hmm. I had a great time revisiting. 30 years, you know, cover a lot of territory.
That's a long time. That's a lot of newsletters.
That's right.
And it comes out monthly.
It comes out monthly, and the book is a little over 400 pages, and we only included a tenth of what was written. So
I hear my favorite recipe made it in, the vinegar eggs.
You know what the French call that? That's translated as the eggs a la the assassin. And
it must be because the sauce
is blood-colored from the... Yeah. From the vinegar, I guess.
It's so simple, and it's so good. Basically, you fry an egg or two.
Slowly.
Slowly.
That's the important thing.
Over very low heat.
Hardly any heat, yeah. In butter.
In butter.
So that the yolks don't cook. You want the whites cooked somewhat, but not the yolks.
Yeah. And then you slip them gently onto a plate.
A warm plate.
Yes, and you add some red wine vinegar, you reduce that down, mm-hmm. and then you finish it with butter.
Right.
And you pour that over the eggs, and you serve it with some lightly toasted Acme bread or Della Fattoria bread, and have a couple of big glasses of Beaujolais alongside. And I always liked how you ended the recipe in the newsletter, "This is not breakfast."
Although, there's another piece that we know that Thomas Jefferson... drank wine with breakfast.
How do we know?
He wrote about it. You know, he didn't write much, but he kept records of everything. And when he was traveling in Europe, there he would write down, you know, Rheingau, you know, with on the breakfast menu and the price he paid. Everything Thomas Jefferson mm-hmm. ever bought, he wrote down how much he paid for it. So you can follow him through life just on the lists of things where he says, "Here, I paid this and that."
Mm-hmm.
And
Was he a spendthrift when it came to wine?
Not at all. What is it? There's several little pieces on him in the Inspiring Thirst book.
Mm-hmm.
I found him so inspirational, so multi-talented, and a great wine connoisseur. He had great taste. And he spent something like half of his presidential salary on food and wine.
Wow.
Imagine
good for
that
him.
Today.
That's amazing.
Couldn't we use that instead of the things they're thinking about in the White House right
couldn't
now?
Couldn't we use that? Yes.
You know, like the president's sitting there troubled. What am I going to drink tonight? Instead of who shall I bomb tomorrow?
How can I get people to quit thinking about, you know, what a bad job I'm doing in Iraq? You know, how about just, should we have a Bordeaux, a Burgundy, or maybe something from Sonoma County tonight? The world would be so much better if that were the case.
Don't bomb, get bombed.
Now, there is a campaign I would like to see. Oh, that's really great. I should say, you're listening to KRCB. My guest this evening, Kermit Lynch, wine merchant, and his fellow musician, Boz Skaggs. Pleasure to have you both here in the studio. We're not going to take another musical break because I don't want to give up talking to you. So we'll just play one more song towards the end.
I feel funny because you're calling me a musician.
Well,
I am not a musician.
You're not a musician.
I'm a failed musician.
Well, there you go. You just dropped the adjective. And what brought you back into music? Just finding those songs and not wanting some of them to disappear?
Well, I'd always liked some of the songs that I wrote, and But I didn't have any nice versions of them. All I had were sort of the garage band tapes that I made when I was playing, or a concert or two very badly recorded, you know. Boz got me into the studio with a bunch of super musicians.
So, Boz, you pushed this project.
I did. Yeah,
cool, good
very,
for you.
I very much encouraged this. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so what a thrill for me to be in the studio with, like, Bonnie Raitt's rhythm section, played with us on I think, almost every cut. We had Alvin Youngblood Hart, great blues man.
Yeah.
And Jackie Payne, the soul singer that you
what
just
a greatest
heard.
Guy. I didn't know him. Yeah. What a gorgeous voice.
Oh, he's got a,
and right here from Santa Rosa.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
Local talent.
Uh-huh. How is this being published? I mean, who's what label?
We're going to put it out on, it's Grey Cat. Right?
Grey Cat Records, yeah.
Grey Cat Records.
Grey Cat Records.
And I don't know how in the world we're going to distribute it. I can't imagine. I don't know where it would belong. Which bin would it go into? There's blues. There's country. There's rock and roll. There's not a lead. There's several singers. There's not just one singer. So I don't know how a CD store could cope with it.
Local.
I don't know. The wine section.
Yeah, there you go. The wine section. You know, local musicians, you know, certainly in the Bay Area.
And, maybe I'll just sell it in my store.
There you go. I'll play you on my music show.
Hey, all right.
And I'm sure other people here at KRCB will. We've got just about 12 minutes left, so let's talk a little bit more about the state of the store and the state of wine today. You've got a 33-year window on the drinking public.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you don't sell just to Bay Area customers. You have a pretty big mail order business as well.
Well,
don't you?
Most of my business, it's a national distribution.
Okay.
Because the mail order has turned out to be impossible with, the government regulations that didn't used to exist. And that's another instance I want to say, in my opinion, it's payoffs. That's why we have that kind of legislation.
Yeah.
It's not to protect anybody except the big wholesalers.
Now, that's up right now. That's in the Supreme Court, and we don't have a ruling yet.
We're waiting for the ruling.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense on how it's going to go?
Well, it sounded like in the hearing that the Supreme Court justices couldn't believe that these rules existed. They couldn't see any logic to them except to protect the big shippers. I'm hoping that our Supreme Court is independent and will rule on it with that frame of mind, and that they can't be influenced.
Mm-hmm. How will it change the world of wine if all of those regulations suddenly are off the books?
Well, a winery like Skaggs, like Boz's, a small winery, it's sort of, I think it'd be a shame if he entered the big distribution system with the quantity he's got.
Yeah.
It would get lost.
Uh-huh.
He could sell it on his own mailing list like that and send it to anybody in the United States.
Yeah, currently it's what, 14 states we can send to?
13 or 14, right. Unbelievable. And in certain states like Florida, it's a felony.
Right.
If I were to ship to a private client in Florida, I'd be guilty of a felony.
Yeah. I know when my daughter, depending on where my daughter has lived, my youngest daughter, I've sent her wine at times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that someone who was packing in one of the, you know, like a mail center sort of informed me that, you know, technically this is a felony to send this.
Mm-hmm.
You might actually want to take another look at that bottle. Perhaps it's not wine. Perhaps it's actually vinegar.
Well, there are liquor stores and wine shops that will send to those states. They'll take the risk, but I have a federal import permit.
Yeah.
And if I
it's a big risk.
Yeah,
for
if
you.
I got caught doing something like that, it wouldn't be treated as lightly. And so I find myself in this strange position. I can't send wine to my father, who lives in Oklahoma. It's illegal for me to send my own wine to my own father. It's just
just so absurd.
It's the craziest situation.
So even if it's not wine that's sold,
and
even
I think
if it's wine
that,
as a gift, you can't send it.
That's right. And I think of that sometimes when I hear the people saying over and over, you know, well, yeah, but we still live in the freest country in the world. And I always go, cut. Yes, but.
Yeah. Can you send wine to... could you send wine to your father if you both lived in France?
Yes, yes, okay. No problem.
Okay, so France doesn't have that.
No, there's no borders for wine. France.
Yeah, how bizarre. But back to the customers over the last 30 years. How have you seen Americans change in the way they drink?
Well, it's been explosive, really, how the market has expanded. And to go into most wine shops these days, I was in a wine shop in San Francisco, Plump Jack's, yesterday, and I couldn't believe the selections from Australia, from New Zealand, and you just go on and on. Worldwide, what a selection in the Bay Area. We're really lucky.
Yeah.
And when I got into the wine business, it was so limited. Even the California wines, there were only a handful of really top vineyards, you know, top quality vineyards. And today I look through the labels at Plump Jack's, and there were so many of them I never heard of them. You know, so an explosion of wine and of wine drinkers.
And you're keeping your focus on mostly French, a little bit of Italian.
That's really what I do. That's what interests me the most.
Yeah.
I like some California wines. It's not that. I was attracted in France and Italy by this idea that a place is so important. You know, like they can't irrigate in France. Right. It's illegal. So you've got the quality of your wine every year, the character of it is different based on the rainfall. In California, you can irrigate. So that gives a sameness to the wines from vintage to vintage. In France and Italy, too, you have the different areas. They grow different grapes. And so you have this diversity that really attracted me. I think that's really what did it.
Yeah, and all these years later, it still attracts you.
Very much so, and I see, though, the way the world is going. We were talking about the hamburgers, you know, a choice of two or three hamburgers. I'm afraid the wine world is sort of on that path. I'm hoping the pendulum will swing back, but it's certainly going that direction with all these just big oaky wines. It's hard to tell them apart.
I really agree with that. As you travel in France, and I know that I've read, I must have been in your newsletters a lot about your travels to Burgundy, Côte d'Or, which is a region of which I'm particularly fond. How have you seen the French countryside and the French way of life evolve since you've been going there?
Just enormous changes. For example, I was thinking of this the other day, and I'm sure people would have a rough time believing me, but when I met Gérard Chauve, he makes a great wine in the Rhone Valley, Hermitage, and this was around 1976, 77, and I was leaving his place to go up and do my tour in Burgundy to select wines. And so I said, "Well, I'm going to Burgundy. Why don't you, you want to come along and do some tasting in Burgundy?" And he said, "Oh, okay. I've never been there. You know, greatest winemaker in the Rhone,
and had never.
It's a two-hour drive. Now today, you see Gérard Chauve. He's been to Australia how many times? Japan, the United States, Canada. He's a world traveler now. And you go back just 30 years ago, he hadn't been to Burgundy. So there's been an exchange of information and everything, of an education that's changed French wine quite a bit. The school, the kids of winemakers, they go to school now in Bordeaux or in Burgundy and learn things. And that's been good. There have been technological advances, but at the same time, they're learning how to make wine the same way, no matter what part of France they come from, and that scares me.
Yeah. What about the way that the people who live in the particular regions, what about the way they eat? You know, is the going home for lunch every day, is the importance of that way of life, do you see that changing?
It's changed completely. I had an idea, this was back in around 1980, because I ate so well on my trips when I was invited to the homes of the winemakers. And the other thing I want to point out is that the wives, if I went to a domain like three or four times for lunch, I noticed oh, they made the same thing last year when I ate here. And then I realize, oh, they know what shows off their wine the best. So they've got their recipes that just make their wine look super, you know, brilliant. And I've noticed that, anyway, I decided, okay, I'm going to do a book. I'm going to collect their recipes so people can see what's the best thing to fix if you're going to drink Chateau Neuf du Pape, for example. Well, in those days, I could have done it. I put it off for years and years, and I made an arrangement with Patricia Wells, a great cookbook writer.
Wonderful cookbook writer. One of our favorites here on Mouthful.
To do that cookbook. And when I started putting the list together, it were the sons and daughters of the winemakers, and it was no longer possible.
Oh, really? So it disappeared in that short time.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, and on that note, we are almost out of time, so I want to make sure we get some details to people. The address of Kermit Lynch Wine Merchant?
It's 1605 San Pablo Avenue in Berkeley.
Is it in the corner of Cedar?
Cedar and San Pablo, uh-huh.
Right there with Acme Brad and Cafe Fanny. Adventures on the Wine Road is the first book, and the new book is Inspiring Thirst, that is from 10 Speed Press. And Boskaggs, what was your first vintage with your wine?
03.
And how do people get it? People in who might be listening.
Oh, if it were only for sale, I would love this opportunity to.
So it's not for sale.
I'll get off. It's not now.
Not now.
We're going through the legal process of getting. But it will be available, and I have a website called BozSkaggs.com, and when it is available, that's where it will be announced.
Okay, so are you going through the BATF process now to get it?
Yes, getting a label approved and all that stuff.
Yeah, and do you think it will be the 03 vintage that is your first release?
03 should be. Yes, it's in warehouse in Bond, and will be released.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck. Wish you a lot of luck.
Thanks,
and can't
Michelle.
Wait to taste it. I love Rhone wines,
okay.
Both from France and from California, so I really look forward to that. And to both of you, thank you so much for being here. It's just a thrill to get to talk to you face-to-face after wanting to have
you
as a guest for so long. And I can't wait to read the new book.
I can't wait to hear my music on the radio.
Well, there you go. So what should we play as a last cut?
Well, let's play a rocker. How about that?
Okay.
Let's see. Which rocker should we play? How about cut number 2, Dirt Road?
Okay. I will see you next week.
I drive down an old dirt road just to see my lady. She lives in a dust-colored hut with a young baby. The furniture used and the dirt on the floor. My friends say I should never see her no more, but I will. I'm gonna see her again, yes I will. She smells.
Local presentation of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour, is made possible in part by the Press Democrat, your local newspaper for over 148 years and 2004 winner of the George Polk Award. The Press Democrat, bringing you news that's important to your life. And from Tandem Winery, celebrating diversity in locally produced radio shows on KRCB, tandemwinery.com, or 823-2794. And JAG Public Relations, providing comprehensive marketing communications, focusing on small and medium-sized businesses in wine, hospitality, and entertainment industries. JAG Public Relations will manage your web content, write copy, and fill your graphic design and still photography needs. More information available at 707-795-9400 or at jagpublicrelations.com.
Get out of my kitchen. Get out of my kitchen. Get out of my kitchen and let me cook.